back. Welcome once again to another edition of Mike, Mike, and Oscar. We're going to be two-thirds of the way through the MCU after this one.
Making moves right now.
I'm your host, Mike. This is my co-host, also Mike.
I am also Mike.
And we are in MCU review number 4, going 3 movies at a time through the Marvel Cinematic Universe on the way up to Avengers Infinity War, and what once seemed like months and months and years in the future is a week away now?
My God.
We're here.
The anticipation has just been growing. I'm super caffeinated. Yeah. I'm hyped for this episode in particular because it has one of my favorite all-time Marvel movies.
Yes, we're close to the finishing touches as well. We almost have all the characters we're going to encounter. Not quite yet, but sure. We're getting there. We're doing today Guardians of the Galaxy, the second Avengers movie, Avengers Age of Ultron, and then we're finishing off with Marvel's Ant-Man, Paul Rudd, taking the superhero mantle. He's a superhero now. Phoebe's boyfriend turned Ant-Man.
Michael Douglas with a very fake beard. I'll have more on that coming.
The young CGI'd Michael Douglas freaked me out at the beginning of that movie. I was not ready for it. Was not prepared for it.
Baby's butt smooth face with a turkey neck.
Yeah, very, very odd combination going on. Yelling at Robert Slattery.
Old crow's feet in the eyes still. They fixed some things. They chose to fix
face of
some.
God, I think. Just an amalgamation of all different body parts.
A little scary.
So let's start with Guardians of the Galaxy. It's the 10th movie in the MCU franchise. Like we said, by the end of this, we'll have 12 movies of the 18 prefacing Infinity War done. Guardians of the Galaxy is number 10. It's the first time being introduced to Star-Lord and company, and Mike is going to get us started with some notes.
Guardians cast and crew, co-written and directed by James Gunn, writer-director of Slither and Super, also co-written by Nicole Perlman, her first major IMDb credit. She was enrolled in the quote-unquote Marvel screenwriting school and brought through those ranks that they developed their writers that way.
We're honing her. It's kind of crazy how many chances Marvel took on people with little or no experience in the action genre, and they've just been hitting aces after aces, making stars out of these people.
Exactly. I mean, their writers program basically asks every writer to choose a property and write it. She abnormally enough chose this one, this obscure property, wrote the hell out of it, got the attention of everybody on top.
Killed it.
Along with her script and the direction of the comics, Kevin Feige kind of got interested. Perlman has written Sherlock Holmes 3, Detective Pikachu, a remake of Labyrinth, Damien Chazelle's First Man, Captain Marvel, and yes, she's written a treatment for the Black Widow film since this movie was released.
All right, so we got a little momentum. You say a remake of Labyrinth was in there?
She's written a remake of Labyrinth, correct?
I don't know that we need that.
Sure.
All right.
I'm not very familiar with Labyrinth.
No, David Bowie is the Elf King? No, you didn't watch that growing up?
No.
I was raised by VHS.
No, that's good.
It's not. It's really not.
Nodding my head. It's great banter for a podcast. I'm not familiar with Labyrinth. I got nothing there. Is David Bowie?
Yes, he was the Elf King. It was. I'm actually surprised you haven't seen it because it seems.
I think I've seen it once.
Yeah, it's overrated.
Okay. More writing credits go to Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning, and many other comic book writers. There's way too many to list here because all these characters are kind of brought in, or some of them are brought in from other comics, other strains of the story. So there's a lot of writing credits going around.
Makes sense.
Guardians of the Galaxy stars, I guess that pun found its way in there. Chris Pratt is Peter Quill. Zoe Saldana is Gamora, daughter of Thanos, adopted daughter. Dave Bautista is Drax the Destroyer. In the role of his career, Vin Diesel is the voice of Groot.
it's really Academy Award winning.
Bradley Cooper is the voice of Rocket Raccoon. The Walking Dead's Michael Rooker is Yondu. Jumanji's Karen Gillan is another Thanos' daughter, Nebula.
Yeah, I didn't realize that was her until after I looked it up on the IMDb page. She was very un-Karen Gillan in this movie.
Demon Hansu, John C. Reilly, Benicio Del Toro, Glenn Close, etc., etc. All of them star in this ensemble piece.
You know, it would be a good discussion one day is to have a debate over who the biggest star that's not in the MCU at all is, like, out there.
Dude, that's a good little podcast fodder.
You can go the Tom Cruise and the George Clooney's, but those are guys that need the big money anyway. But somebody along the lines of
Emily Blunt,
I don't know.
John Krasinski, I heard that somewhere.
Not familiar with those names.
Guardians box office, its budget was $170 million. Domestic earnings, $333 million.
There you go.
International earnings, $440 million.
Bring them in.
Worldwide total was $773.3 million.
Important to note, too, that this movie came out in the dead of summer, in a dead month, August.
Yep.
Where nobody thought it was going to do anything. They kind of thought it was Marvel's experiment, and Marvel's experiment made $700 million again.
Oh, yes. Now, it did go over budget, technically speaking, to something like 236. I read this on Wikipedia, so I think that budget number is actually 200. They got a rebate from the British government because they filmed a lot of these scenes in Surrey, England, and in sound stages there. They got a rebate of $36 million. That's not my production nugget, but that's just true.
That should have been
I retained information when I read it.
Fun paperwork to fill out, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Dear Britain, may we please have some pounds back?
Third highest grossing film of 2014. It's also the third highest grossing Marvel film to date.
How about that, huh? For a property that, I mean, you can't tell me unless you read the comics. You were familiar with Star-Lord and Gamora.
No,
and yeah,
no idea. It's also been a huge moneymaker in terms of toys and merchandising.
Of course.
I think they had a clue about that much, though, because they kind of really went all in on all these different toy producers.
Well, Groot and Rocket alone are two. They speak to children, especially with the second Guardians when we'll get to it. Baby Groot being introduced. I mean, these are kids' properties for sure.
And I was fascinated to find that Wikipedia cited that the film made, as of October 2015, $118 million on home media.
Oh, nice. So
we got one of those numbers.
We always talk about how those numbers are very few and far between, and it's tough to get their hands on them to see the full picture of what these movies actually do when they're released to VOD and Blu-ray and all that stuff, but nice.
So that seems like a couple hundred million dollars profit, two to three there. That's not including merchandising. Again, we suck at this math, but I think we can safely say it's a big score.
It's inching its way to $1 billion property overall.
Right, overall.
The home media included.
I would guess as much. Guardians critical reception, Rotten Tomatoes, a high 91%, 7.7 out of 10 critic score, 92%, 4.4 out of 5 audience rating, high numbers there. Mm-hmm. Metascore was 76.
That's high. Metascore has been trending downward, yeah. That's
big. IMDb 8.1 out of 10 from 829,000 votes. That's a lot of votes. A
lot of people like this movie.
Cinema score was a big fat A.
There you go.
Awards for Guardians of the Galaxy, nominated for 2 Oscars, Best Achievement in Makeup and Hairstyling, and Best Visual Effects.
I think that's the high mark for any Marvel MCU movie right now.
I think so, and 2 BAFTAs as well. It lost to the Grand Budapest Hotel for Makeup and Hairstyling. It lost to Interstellar for Visual Effects. It was nominated alongside The Winter Soldier in that category.
So you could see, as far as the Oscar lens of these movies go, Guardians came out in 2015, so we're slowly, after 8 years of these films, the Academy slowly coming around on them, starting to accept them as more serious, getting them nominated more often. It's only going to be a good thing.
The whole world screaming at the Academy that these movies are great and they're good and they're most memorable of the year.
These are your best stories of the year, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, all our money and resources are going towards them. Why don't we recognize it a little more? Its soundtrack was nominated for a Grammy for Best Music Supervision for films budgeted over $25 million.
Now let's get this on Broadway. Let's get this on TV. Let's eke out this movie.
Once Disney, gets through Marvel Phase 7 and, it's 50 years from now.
Broadway plays? They'll
remake them in an animated movies, which won't be animated. It'll just be computer-generated real people.
Well, they're going to be chips implanted into our heads by that point, I think. Yeah, that's where we're headed. But the soundtrack is huge in this movie, obviously. I mean, this is the whole marketing of this movie was based on Hooked on a Feeling, that's 1960s song.
It's essential to the plot, that playlist. It sets up a ton of the jokes.
Ooga chaka, ooga chaka.
Yes. And obviously, it's a tone setter. Guardians of the Galaxy was nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay at the Writers Guild Awards. So now the guilds are starting
to
pay attention.
Very serious, yeah.
Yes.
Awesome.
Some other key awards, I'll go through them fast. Best Actor, Chris Pratt. Best Director, James Gunn. Makeup and Comic to Film at the Academy of Sci-Fi. Best Fantasy Film at the Art Directors Guild. Critics' Choice, Best Hair and Makeup, and Best Action Movie, Empire Award for Best Female Newcomer, Karen Gillan, Hollywood Blockbuster Award to James Gunn, Makeup and Hairstylist Guild Awards for Best Contemporary Makeup and Best Special Makeup Effects, Hugo Award for Best Dramatic Film Presentation, IGN Summer Movie Award for Best Feature, so a lot of auxiliaries.
It's so cool to see, and maybe we will look back when a Marvel picture finally does win, or at least nominated for a Best Picture.
Right.
We'll look back and see the Guardians. This could be the turning point, because this was kind of, like I said, we were trending down with the meta ratings. The cinema scores were bouncing all over the place as far as versus how they were critically and audience received. But now we got like a legitimate stud here. Two Oscar nominations, a bunch of Guild nominations and awards, and high scores across the board.
But it's too much fun. It can't be nominated for Oscars.
And that's kind of the thing. It's a little bit of a change in tone between what we've been coming with in the MCUs. I mean, we're just off the Winter Soldier, which is political controversy on top of conspiracy and all
intense.
And now we're having, you know, jokes on jokes on jokes.
Leading into Avengers, which was kind of a serious movie as well.
Right.
Anyway, my one production nugget, James Gunn said the hardest scene to write was the Thanos introduction. But when they all decided that Thanos should demean Ronan and that Ronan should kill the other, his, you know, Thanos is a vizier, that's when the scene started to work. They kind of gave these guys some action to go on.
Yeah, we have our first speaking Thanos role. It took 10 movies, but we're finally here when we get to see the big bad reveal himself and say some words.
So, and that's a lot of pressure on this new franchise.
Oh, yeah.
They must have felt they had something good here. So, Mike, you got the plot premise.
Still don't think it should be Josh Brolin, though. You can't I mean, Thanos and Cable? Come on.
You wanted to do it yourself.
I'm available. Very available. Guardians of the Galaxy, give you a quick plot overview. Chris Pratt goes from Parks Department doofus Andy Dwyer to bona fide protector of the galaxy Star-Lord, a.k.a. Peter Quill, in the 10th installment into the MCU. Quill, Gamora, Rocket Raccoon, Groot, and Drax the Destroyer all have a few things in common. They're each interested in a mysterious globe that's worth a potential fortune. They're each on the run from Thanos' underling and main movie baddie Ronan, and until their agreement to work together and break out of the kiln, aka space prison, they were each pretty much a loner and an outcast. This movie is about the chase for the aforementioned orb, which, wouldn't you know it, this being the MCU movie and all, actually contains another of the coveted Infinity Stones, this time a purple one. While trying to sell the stone to the collector, who we saw in the post-credits scene of Thor the Dark World, mayhem erupts thanks to the all-too-literal Drax laying out a challenge to Ronan directly. This leads to Star-Lord choosing to save the life of Thanos' quote-unquote daughter, turned vengeance-seeking badass Gamora, over protecting the stone, which does in fact land in the hands of Ronan. Ronan, with stone in hand, though, chooses to double-cross Thanos, wanting instead to keep the stone for himself and the power that comes with it to destroy the planet of Xander and then others as he sees fit. Star-Lord has to operate with his back figuratively and literally against the wall in convincing the bounty hunter that dragged him from Earth in the first place, Yondu, to spare his life, having been the ones responsible for taking in Star-Lord and Gamora in their time of need earlier, and instead do the right thing, or at least the profitable thing, and help retrieve the stone from Ronan for themselves to sell later. Team now with Yondu, his men, the Nova Police Department, and his newfound Guardian friends, we get our big blow-off as Star-Lord and company truly become the Guardians of the Galaxy and quite literally need to rely on one another in order to save each other's lives at various points and defeat Ronan once and for all, getting back the stone and keeping it safe on Xander, not giving it to Yondu. So that's kind of our plot layout with Guardians of the Galaxy going forward. Here, let's talk about where it fits into the MCU. Nowhere.
No, it sets up the key villain in the Infinity War there with Thanos.
They're so lucky to have this property, too, because, yeah, you're right. The big bad is this space god. And how are you going to introduce him into a series that you've so grounded in Earth and real-time Earth, New York, San Francisco, or Oakland, all that stuff?
Right.
You have this property that's in space already, that's introducing all this. It's the Star Wars, the space drama of Marvel Universe.
I figure that when they decided on Ultron, they were kind of like, okay, Guardians has to happen now because we're not doing another alien plotline for the Avengers. You know,
so right.
We can't really work Thanos into the Infinity War that away. We got to give him another way in. I'm sure Kevin Feige kind of got the ball rolling with that. You know, it helps to have Nicole Perlman write a great script. It helps to have the comics go in a different direction so that they can really sink their teeth into the property. So, yeah, I mean, this is like a full-fledged planet-hopping science fiction. This is a space opera film from Marvel Studios. I thought that was genius, going full genre
movie here. Unexpected, totally unexpected. And look, it can go pound for pound with a lot of Star Wars movies.
Yeah, and it's the Han Solo origin story that we never got and probably are getting now too late.
Or may not be getting correctly even. Exactly. Mean, they're not going to do it better than this, I don't think.
It's the movie about the scoundrels. Yeah, it's the movie outlaw, about the Inglorious Bastards. As James Gunn said during his promotional interviews, it's based on the Dirty Dozen. Him and Nicole Perlman kind of really thought about the Dirty Dozen with the old Western scoundrels, sure, you know, facing off against the aggressors of that town. You got some Last Starfighter influence. You got some Indiana Jones, of course. So it's a real fun mishmash in terms of its derivatives. But I just love how they stuck to the guns of the space opera genre, which if you read a lot of science fiction novels, if you've seen a lot of movies, obviously space operas have been very popular in TV series form.
Mm-hmm.
They're always about making friends. I mean, that's the theme of those, of most of those stories.
Loners finding their way with other people.
Loners, yeah, adrift in space.
Mm-hmm. For
stuck
sure.
Stuck in horrible, lowly enterprises and in the forest parts of the galaxy.
And it's usually beings of different, not absolutely, races, yes, but they're different races, different
species.
People. Species is the word,
yeah,
I was
absolutely
looking for.
And this just totally buys into that, yeah, genre. It just really showcases the story very well. And the characters.
I couldn't be. I mean, this, I said to you a couple times, I think this is my favorite movie thus far in the MCU, having gone through 12 of them so far. This is just beautiful. The way it was all done and Thanos being introduced couldn't have done better, because the first thing we see hear him talk about is demeaning his own daughter right in front of him,
right,
demeaning his underling in true big, bad asshole form.
Yes.
Nobody's good enough for him. He wants to do everything himself. All he wants is the power and the glory, and he wants to rule the universe and blah, blah, blah. Then you have Ronan, who's just as capable a bad guy because he's the main bad guy in the movie, kind of turning on his boss at the end there and wanting to take it all for himself.
So Ronan is not necessarily a complicated villain in terms of his motivations.
Oh, no.
But to the lengths to which he goes is nuts. He goes to 13, never mind 11. And I think Lee Pace is just playing that part with relish.
He was great. He was really, really good. In a movie where a lot of people are really good, I thought he was really well done. Admittedly, I'm not familiar with his work prior to this movie, so he was kind of a neophyte in my mind.
I think he's terrific in Halt and Catch Fire, amongst other things.
He blew it out of the water for me. He was great as Ronan. I'd like to see more of him. I know it's probably not possible now, but...
So just in terms of major plot points, I mean, this was a heavy intro. I mean, mother dying, poor little kid.
Mother dying of cancer, kid refusing to take her hand for the last time when she asks, and going outside to cry and bereave, and...
Some hints that he's might be, you know, the son of a space god. We don't know that yet.
He's the son of someone special. His mother was Terran, and his father was something special. We find out at the end of the movie from
the mother in that first scene is what I'm saying. She hints at it a little bit. You are my little star, whatever she said.
Right.
She didn't say Star-Lord in that scene, but yes. However, that kind of abduction, the alien abduction, comes out of nowhere, but that was a little surprising. So
it was quick. Yeah. You could quibble with it. It's not one of my worst scenes, but you have to get him up in space somehow. If you're going to start with an Earthling, you got to explain how he got up there. So yeah, it's a quick explanation, but
instead of going through like his growing up years, his formative years, they cut right to him, full Indiana Jones. And what I loved about this story is instead of Indiana Jones just, you know, obtaining a whatever to establish and set up his character, they actually obtain, in this movie, the Infinity Stone, the MacGuffin of the whole film. What you think
right
is
away.
Just an Indiana Jones, whatever, the relic, that doesn't matter, is actually the most important thing of the whole film.
Yeah, right away, too. And it's becomes somewhat of a chase scene, or chase movie in space, because you have a bunch of these different groups converging for this stone or for different characters.
Which is so much fun, because... You know, fantasy stories do this a lot where, again, you know, space opera and the flip side of that is epic fantasy. They do it in an on-the-road movie, you know, the quest. And all the weird friends come together. They argue. They bump heads, especially when it's one of those about scoundrels on the run together. So it was genius because you have this super powerful villain who has no sense of humor. And then you have all these funny characters that, butt heads every step of the way. They're getting hunted down by him.
And in so many different ways, too. I mean, the humor from the Guardians cast, the Guardians crew is, you have Star-Lord, who's the sarcastic dick. Gamora is kind of the level-headed conscience of the group.
Yes.
Rocket, I don't think has ever been serious a day in his life. Groot can't speak, but he can speak, but he can't speak. And Drax is the deadpan straight, takes everything literal. I mean, there's so many different kinds
of
humor.
There on the WWE mic?
No, listen, Batista was like, he's been a funny guy. He can work the mic, yeah, but he's never been shown the kind of chops to like play it so dumbfounded, basically, and so literal.
He was
really, really good in this role.
Yeah, a bunch of a-holes. I mean, just an hysterical scene. Because everybody, and then you get like, you get straight, you know, the straight man kind of characters surrounding these nut jobs. But I loved how they each have particular, just needling for one another in multiple ways.
That's how you know they're not a group yet. And that's so beautiful about this story is that they're not a group until the very end when they know they need each other.
Like Gamora keeps harping on the same two things with Drax, the same two things with Peter. And Peter just keeps getting pissed off about Groot. And Drax keeps breaking Rocket's balls about the fact that he's a rodent. And oh my God, it's
well written. This is probably the most well written script.
They're breaking each other's balls for the whole movie, which is real. It's like just like real friends do. So I mean, yes, X-Men, the Avengers, maybe closer comps in terms of a Act One and Act Two there. But again, this one really connects with the space opera genre, and I love how you have this dueling story where the antagonism is deadly serious, the protagonists are funny, and then of course the crescendo of the movie is something that is almost funny, is kind of funny, and then they actually employ their plan at the very end there. So I just thought that was brilliant. It really worked for me.
I'll say it again, probably the tightest script in the MCU, which is high praise, because we've had a lot of tight scripts.
So let's keep praising it. You got best scenes?
I got a lot. I got a lot of best scenes. First of all, let's start. How about how Groot is the most progressive character in the MCU?
Oh, yeah.
Because when Rocket and Groot are supposed to be capturing Star-Lord at the very beginning to collect the bounty on his head, and Rocket...
Learn genders, man!
Rocket says, put him in the bag! Groot wraps up Gamora.
Yes.
Rocket's complete. You gotta learn genders, man!
So why are you lying?
It's 2018, and Groot doesn't see gender anymore. So progressive.
No, sure. It's funny.
I like the our first speaking Thanos lines I loved, even though, again, I have a problem with Brolin playing both Thanos and Cable, especially now with Disney kind of owning everything, but that's a different argument for a different day. How about the scene in the kiln? Rocket's explaining how they need that battery from that light on the wall.
Freaking Cortex battery! This is funny.
We're just coming off Thor the Dark World, where they have this long, elaborate plan to escape that takes up basically the entire second act of the movie. Here we have the discussion that you think is going to be the big planning of how we're going to do this. Okay, we need that battery. And we have Rocket talking with Star-Lord and Gamora how they're going to do these things.
Yes.
And Groot just wanders off in the middle of the conversation.
To get that last.
Rips it right off the wall. And the alarm sounds. Like, or we could just go get it first and improvise from there. That killed me.
And I knew the prosthetic leg thing was funny as hell.
Oh, my God. Rocket killed me this whole movie.
Oh, yeah. They're having fun. They're screwing around. Breaking out of jail. And of course, Rocket having no temperament and being so short-tempered that he can't explain his plans is just brilliant. It's hysterical.
My best scene overall, it comes towards the end of the movie, but it's a layout, basically. It's the conclusion of what you said. Because you have all this ball busting, you get to know these characters, you see their development, you see they're forming as friends. All the big sappy scenes worked for me.
Yeah.
Like when Drax is talking about how you are now my friend. This guy is now my friend before we have our final confrontation with Nebula. He even said, this green whore is now talking about Gamora. I mean, it's funny, but the big sappy stuff, when Star-Lord needs to pep them up and say, you know, I know I'm asking you to die. And then Rocket eventually says, well, here we are. Bunch of jackasses standing around. I mean, they finished every emotional scene with a funny one-liner, but it worked and it got me. I bought right into it. What about you?
Yes, totally in with all that. I want to say that I loved how the big sequences worked. The opening, Indiana Jones.
For
sure. Xandar Street scene with Groot, Rocket, Gamora, and Peter. You know, that kind of meet cute in a very Marvel space opera way. Obviously, the prison sequence was funny. It was awesome. And where they're shooting the guns at those robots, just screaming. How great was that? How great of a moment is that? And then, of course, the battle at the very end for Xandar was fun and was innovative. I'm a big fan of it. I love the fact that you finally see Yondu do his thing on the ground there. Mm-hmm. I love the fact
that arrow that he teases the whole movie.
Yeah, that final reversal where they're goofing around the whole movie, so it makes sense that he goofs around at the end, dance battle, and then he just makes you laugh a little bit. So this guy's like, what? No sense of humor. He just, his brain short circuits.
It's such a credit to the writing of this movie. It's such a credit that the absurdity works.
Yeah, and you think Rocket is just making weapons before to make you laugh. No, he's making weapons because he's Chekhov's weapons maker, and he's making that weapon quick so he could just shoot the Infinity Stone out of that guy's hammer or axe thing, whatever. So I love the big moments. I love the little moments. I love Peter Quill grabbing the rat and singing in the first scene. I love the tough prison guy who backs down to Drax all the time. That was my favorite knife. Like I said, the screwing around while they escape from prison is hysterical. That extra shot he gives to the guard with electricity there. He swiping the orb from Gamora's grasp, you know, that little 1-2. That's something he'll do with Yondu later. I love all the nowhere stuff. I mean, Groof giving the little girl the flower was touching.
Very touching.
But the whole gambling Oasis thing was hysterical. When they cut to them just screaming and yelling and drunk.
When they're waiting for the collector to call them in, yeah.
Of course, the collector followed by... The whole collector thing was interesting. It kind of pulled in the series visually, you know, because we've seen that little whatever idea bubble diagram thing showing all the realms.
Right.
So we've seen that before. So that kind of pulled in the rest of the MCU a little bit in terms of that visual. After they get out of the collector, or before, I forget what it was, but Rocket makes fun of Peter's purse. He's like, why are you carrying around that thing in your purse? It's not a purse, it's a knapsack. I mean, all these little tiny moments are very funny. And then Groot is like the Hulk character in this movie. Like, when he goes off physically, it does something.
Oh, he's the menace, for sure.
You get that huge laugh when he just loses his shit with all those henchmen inside, and that final sequence where they're besieging the throne room or the command center of the...
In that line of a second wave. And that's another thing this movie does well, is it handles misdirection so well. Like, you think you're going to get the big battle with Nebula and Gamora, and then Drax blasts Nebula mid-sentence. You think you're going to get a second wave of henchmen coming in. Groot takes them out in one branch.
Yes. So a million things to love in this movie, which makes it hard for me to find worse scenes, but maybe you could remind me.
I have two. One is nothing. I mean,
because it's not a perfect movie. I don't pretend.
No, it's not. I don't think it's a perfect movie, but it's just maybe my favorite and might be the best thus far of the first 10.
Yeah.
Does Groot, the We Are Groot, the demise of Groot at the end, obviously emotionally scarring.
Oh, that's what I have too. Yeah.
But has that been mentioned? Was that mentioned at all, that he is actually capable of being disposed if he exerts himself like that? Well, I don't think that was set up,
until
was it?
Rocket says it in the ball of
Groot.
Yeah,
at the end, yeah.
Rocket's like, no, Groot, you'll die.
Right, right. And I thought that was, you know, they could have at least thrown a line of dialogue that he's can't expire, right?
Well, right. They really don't say how he'll die, but yeah. I didn't like how they made us wait for too long, but that's really not a gripe. That's just like...
Wait for what?
Wait to show us dancing baby Groot, damn it. I was very sad because I wanted to be super happy, and I couldn't be super happy until I knew Groot was okay. Right. And then, yeah, so...
My biggest negative, though, and it's one that I actually do have a problem with that takes some points off for me, that NovaCorps buys immediately Star-Lord saying, we need your help, Ronan's the bad guy, help us get the orb.
They made a joke about that. Now, if the joke didn't work for you, I get it. But the whole, I might be an a-hole, but
yeah,
I'm not
100%
a dick.
That's fine, but like, you just escaped from their prison. Well, you are a convict.
Yeah, well, that's why John C. Reilly told Glenn Close that they have no reason to come back here to help us. I mean, they're fugitives. They're fugitives from us, so we should believe them.
I get it, but like, that's what you're basing this all on? You're going to send all your forces out for support?
Oh, so you think the fact that he's like, crying wolf makes him
unreliable? Could we have had
John
C. Reilly question it a little more? Could we have had Glenn Close say, like, maybe this isn't a good idea?
I don't remember thinking back to those sequences that whether or not they could confirm it, you know, what do they call corroborate?
It's basically Glenn Nova Prime asking John C. Reilly's character, do you buy it? And John C. Reilly saying yes. That's the benefit of the doubt they give it. You just had this dramatic escape from this inescapable prison. I just thought they could have used a little more deference, I guess.
You might not be wrong. Maybe a little more characterization or storytelling. Another scene, something short. So Oscar Lenz, now I'm gonna say some big things here, Michael.
Yeah, go for it.
This was my favorite movie of 2014. This was my number one. This is the first time a Marvel movie was my number one. I think Avengers was my number four a couple years earlier.
Okay.
So in the year of Imitation Game, American Sniper, Theory of Everything, I totally think this movie's good enough to be in the Best Picture conversation.
Wow.
Should it have won over Birdman, Whiplash, Selma, Gone Girl? Gone Girl wasn't nominated. I thought it should have been as well. But should it have won over those other movies? I don't know. You can make an argument that they're better movies, but to me, this was my favorite movie of the year. I wonder if we had a podcast back then, if I would have argued. But it's a low A for me. It's a 93. So I would have put it up for Best Picture, Best Director, Best Adapted Screenplay contender. And remember when I was trying to figure out my fifth Best Director? I would put this over the Russo brothers back when we did Winter Soldier.
Oh, yeah, sure.
So we had nice continuity there. So James Gunn, I give him a ton of credit pulling this thing together.
Wow, so you're all in on this. Awesome to hear.
I'm all in. I loved it.
I wish I had the balls to say Best Picture. I didn't. I chickened out. I gave it an adapted screenplay, but I feel like we've been doing adapted screenplay a lot with a lot of the big Marvel movies. So I went a little differently as well with one of the main big seven. Has a voice actor ever won an Academy Award? I looked it up. I couldn't find any.
I don't think so.
Rocket is the best supporting actor. The supporting actor is supposed to be the sidekick that has the emotional moments, that's got the witty one-liners,
yes,
and that really supports the film and the actions of the main character in one way or the other, whether they're a protagonist or an antagonist. That's what Rocket is in this movie. I absolutely would have had Bradley Cooper nominated for this performance, especially J.K. Simmons won it for Whiplash, fine. Mark Ruffalo for Foxcatcher, fine. Edward Norton for Birdman, fine. Ethan Hawke in Boyhood was nominated. I know you hate that movie more than I did, but Robert Duvall, that performance in The Judge was soulless. He was not a big fan of that movie. Didn't look like it.
That movie might be too bad to be nominated.
Yeah, I agree. So I think Bradley Cooper could have had a couple chances to be nominated there just because he was hysterical. He was emotional. He kind of had the perspective when the movie really called for it. A bunch of jackasses standing in a circle.
Wow. Now, American Sniper, The Theory of Everything, there's no way in hell you can tell me that those two movies were adapted better and those screenplays are better than this one.
It's a fair argument.
There's no way. And I have fucking $1 billion to back me up, you know, versus those two. So give me a break. It's bullshit. It's bias. It's so wrong. The fact that this movie is just fun to start from start to finish shouldn't disqualify it. The fact that it has all these resources poured into it should, instead of disqualifying it, should build it up, should give you more of a hint, this is good stuff. But the Academy in 2014 and 2015, I feel like they're almost going against the tent poles, going against the big superhero franchises. They're not embracing them at all. Just because that's where all the resources are going. Right. It's almost like a stubbornness,
totally,
and a vindictiveness,
agree.
You know, to make art
how it's coming off. Yeah,
it's unfortunate.
And I know it's that Mr. Mechanic who just left, who was a former governor of the Academy, when he penned that resignation letter last week, that was one of his big gripes, is that we're awarding too many small films just because they're small films, and where the Academy is becoming
downsized. It's not pound for pound the best movie of
the
year.
Agree.
It's not the Indie Spirit Awards.
No, totally agree. It's supposed to be the best in cinema. Just two things before we move on. Post-credit scene, the Collector is still alive, though his shack is wasted. He's sharing a drink with Howard the fucking Duck.
And the space dog, which is kind of funny. The Russian space dog is in this movie.
So probably just a one-off there for Marvel fans. I doubt they're going to do another Howard the Duck movie. If they do, bring George Lucas back too for it.
Oh, God.
Stanley cameo in this movie when Rocket's searching around looking for a bounty, and he's looking for Star-Lord in the very beginning.
Yes.
He makes a quip about an old man hitting on a young woman. That old man is Stanley. Creeper alert. So let's move on, right?
Sure.
Number 11.
Avengers Age of Ultron specs. Ultron cast and crew written and directed by Joss Whedon. Other writing credits go to Stan Lee, Jack Kirby, and Joe Simon. Several others, but too many to mention again. All the Avengers are back. Robert Downey Jr., Chris Hemsworth, Chris Evans, Scarlett Johansson, Jeremy Renner, Don Cheadle, Samuel L. Jackson, Paul Bettany, with key additions Aaron Taylor Johnson, Elizabeth Olsen, the voice of James Spader, plus a ton of cameos from the MCU movies thus far.
How good of a bad guy is James Spader?
He's pretty good.
Oh my God, his voice.
How
was
good
made.
Did Ultron look, by the way, too? I was totally effects, ready for a
the
cartoon.
Effects in this, yeah, they're yeah. amazing.
Oh,
that's another thing. We didn't even talk about it in Guardians, but seeing the effects now compared to what we had in the Incredible Hulks and Iron Man 2s and stuff, it's not even close.
Like, how is this not a best visual effects nominee in every year? It's just nonsense. Ultron box office. Its budget was $250 million, listed budget anyway. Domestic earnings, $459 million. International, $946.
Good God.
Worldwide box office total, $1,405,403,694.
The domestic box office was just basically icing. I mean, they hit $1 billion internationally alone. That's unbelievable.
Seventh highest grossing film of all time. Ultron.
And Infinity War is going to blow it away.
Oh,
imagine
yeah.
that. Oh, man.
Movies are dead, though, Mike.
Yeah, no. Cinema's dead.
Age of Ultron, critical reception. Rotten Tomatoes gave it a 75%, 6.7 out of 10 critic score. 83%, 4.1 out of 5 audience rating. Metascore was a 66. Cinema score was an A, big fat A.
I can't remember the last MCU cinema score that wasn't in that A, B plus, A minus, A range. I mean,
it's delivering goods to the fans.
They're big fan hits.
Fans are loving it. 7.4 out of 570K votes on IMDb. Guardians had almost 900,000 votes.
Yeah, we're taking a step back. We're definitely taking a step back.
This made more money, but kind of garnered less of a reaction from people.
Maybe less rewatches. I don't know. But we're taking a step back both in fan reviews and in not in box office but in critical reception. I mean, Guardians was up there for Metascore and all that, and we're kind of dipping back in the 70s and 60s.
To be honest, I've probably seen Guardians 7, 8, 9 times, whatever it is now, and I saw it 3 times in theaters. I watched it twice for this podcast, so yeah, it's probably up to 8, 9 times, and I've seen this movie maybe 3 times.
I always think in a trilogy, if you're gonna label the Avengers movie as a trilogy, the second movie's always the toughest to pull off anyway.
Yes.
Because you have the introduction and you have the ending. That's the easiest to, I mean, you know, it's obviously highly difficult to do, but
the middle, man, the endless middle.
The middle one is difficult.
Guess what actor my story is currently in while it's written
the last
right
15
now.
Years.
So no best visual effects nomination, WTF.
That's sad. That's not right. I mean, if nothing else, yeah, you can gripe with the story in this one and some of the surprises, but
they have some misfires. They have some awkward shots where you say it's okay, maybe it's a little cartoonish there. Do you think that disqualifies it? But the highs are just so
exactly.
high.
Exactly. And what are we talking about with visual effects here? Because if we're talking most wrong, then yeah, this probably does have the most wrong because it also uses the most visual effects out of any movie that year. So when the whole movie is basically shot like that and still real, don't you give it the credit for what it does?
It's like these movies like need their own category at the Oscars, in my opinion.
Big budget visual effects, it makes sense.
It's kind of silly. So winner, it won some auxiliary awards. Best costume design at the Academy of Science Fiction. Annie for outstanding animated effects. So there you go. Behind the Voice Actors Awards, it won Best Male Lead Vocal Performance in a Feature Film, James Spader. There you go again.
Nice.
Best Film Music to Brian Tyler and Danny Elfman, BMI Film and TV Award. Won a Golden Trailer, and it won a Teen Choice Award to Best Scene Stealer, Chris Evans.
Man, I remember the trailer for Ultron. I didn't see it in theaters. This is my first time watching it.
Because that was a good trailer.
That trailer was awesome. Just James Spader's talk singing.
You have willpower, my friend. You have willpower. So, production nuggets filmed in England, Italy, South Korea, Bangladesh, and New York City, like a James Bond movie there.
Wow.
Also, this is by far the longest plot summary in the history of Wikipedia. That is a lot of scrolling to get to the bottom of this. I'm so relieved I'm not doing it, and I'm very afraid of what you're about to say, but I have confidence in you.
I have I think, 4 paragraphs. So let's see how quickly we can do this.
Okay.
We got no strings to hold the Avengers together in this one as the road to Civil War intensifies to its biggest boiling point yet. Tony has fear, very real fear, which we see courtesy of Ultron Disciple and, conversely, future Avenger Scarlet Witch, who has the ability to read minds. It's that fear, the fear of leading the Avengers' demise and to their individual deaths, that motivates Tony to create the Ultron program, basically an attempt to implement a more progressive and complete version of the Jarvis mainframe into the Iron Man-esque sentry robots that Stark envisions as being able to protect the world from whenever the aliens from Avengers 1 decide to show back up again. There are only 2 little issues with this. One, he tries to do this without any other Avenger knowing, save for Bruce Banner, deciding he'd rather ask for forgiveness than permission, knowing how vehemently against the idea Captain America would be
right
to creating another potential WMD Big Brother service.
Civil War coming up.
Oh, and 2, the Ultron program becomes self-aware and, in calculating the way in which it should save the Earth, decides that the most efficient way to do so for humans to evolve would be to create a catastrophic event, you know, like a giant meteor that would be sent hurling towards the Earth, forcing life to adapt and start anew. And if humans can't survive, so be it, including and especially the Avengers. Ultron, being a computer program, is able to occupy multiple sentry bots at once, which creates the MCU's most unique villain to date. And it is, in fact, that aforementioned plan involving a meteor that is his ultimate goal. Only instead of some space rock, he decides to use an entire city as the object of impact. Short on time and long on potential casualties, Stark deduces that Jarvis, originally believed to have been destroyed in the system by Ultron, was actually infiltrating Ultron and trying to configure how to destroy it from within. This leads Tony to repeat the "don't tell Captain I'm doing this" science once again, aided by Banner and finished by Thor, creating an actual sentient being that has both Jarvis's operating system and Loki's Infinity Stone.
Mm.
A being that was originally to be Ultron's final form, a living, breathing, and if Ultron had it his way, indestructible, Vision. Instead, Vision is a new Avenger, along with Scarlet Witch and her twin brother Quicksilver, and all of them must work with their original favorites in order to end Ultron once and for all and stop a city from destroying all life on the planet in meteor form. How'd I do?
That's bravo. Bravo. Well done. Thank well you. Done. If I can put in an applause track of the whole stadium cheering, I would do it.
Thank you.
So,
thank you.
Guardians of the Galaxy, I forgot to mention, we finally got an Infinity Stone that's not on Earth!
Yes!
But
yes,
we have our third found Infinity Stone on Earth at this point. I know it came from Loki and it came from somewhere. I mean,
Thor says it's our fourth at the end of the movie, and he doesn't know about the one.
Well, it's our fourth now. It's our third on Earth, yeah.
No, because he doesn't know about the ones the Guardians have yet.
Did I miss one? I might have missed one.
We missed one somewhere, because I missed it too. I had to ask my brother about it.
So there's, okay. There's
another one floating out there.
And then, well, there's one, and then there's one in Wakanda. Is that all 6, I guess? So Thanos doesn't...
Well, Doctor Strange has one too, right? So...
Interesting.
I don't know.
We should probably get that information down.
Hey, where's this fit in the MCU?
So, Tony immediately has an army of Iron Man robots after destroying them all at the end of Iron Man 3. We kind of said it was just a hollow gesture.
Thank God he's a billionaire. Yeah. So explain all these things
to me. No, I'm done. Yeah. I'm done with my Iron Man. See, babe? No, come on. We knew he wasn't done.
What if Bruce Wayne and Tony Stark were just sandwich artists at Subway instead? And they didn't have the Infinity Bankroll to explain all these things away.
I don't want to be Batman anymore. Let me just, you know, blow up my cave. Yeah, but shut up, Bruce Wayne and Tony Stark.
And you too, Banner.
Banner too.
Yeah, so where does this fit in the MCU? So we have our second gathering of all the Avengers. We're fighting pretty geniusly, I think. It's probably the most layered bad guy since Loki, or at least including Loki.
Oh, yes. I loved what they did with the antagonism in this movie. You kind of know, after all these movies that we dealt with on Earth, with the Avengers, whatever, that the villains are going to give you a twist, right? I mean, last few movies that we've seen, Guardians took a more direct approach, mm-hmm. even though they kind of stripped down the villain by the end with comedy. Now you have a very quick reversal, because you think Hydra is going to be the villain. And this was my biggest problem with the Winter Soldier, the Hydra nonsense and the tonal mashup of the awesome realistic fighting and the silly cartoon villain. Now you have Joss Whedon saying, okay, you give me Hydra to set up my movie? This is what I think of Hydra. I'm going to make a few punchlines out of it and get them the hell off my screen. I love that.
Yeah.
Loved it. Completely loved it.
So not only does he get rid of Hydra, which is, you can argue it's superfluous. I know you have your issues with it, and they're not done yet. They come back. You also, the bad guy, Ultron, is essentially just Civil War.
So, yeah.
I mean, it's Tony's mindset against Captain America's mindset already. Here we are.
They are planning for Civil War, of course. Yeah, absolutely. So, Tony's screw-ups reach a new height, which makes him gun-shy, which makes him say, maybe I should...
The de-evolution of a mentally stable Tony Stark in this.
I don't think I can handle this on my own. I don't think I can run this group on my own. I don't think I can go without the governments and the regular people's help.
The Playboy facade is just the facade.
Yeah, because I've fucked up, and he screws up so bad he almost causes the demise of the planet. So, yes, Tony Stark has been screwing up left and right as of the last movie. They carry that to 11 here.
And they show us a scene that's going to be in Infinity War, you have to think. I mean, that scene when Scarlet Witch is looking in Tony's head and all the Avengers are, and you could see the back of Thanos' throne.
I was going to ask you that.
That has to be in Infinity War.
So, is she a prophet, or is she someone who just takes the worst things from their brains, like the whatever self-fulfilling prophecies or whatever you want to call it? Is she just showing them their fears?
Or that's a good question. Is she looking into the future? Yeah, that's a good question.
Is she an oracle or whatever? Because that scares me, and how much. Like, this movie legitimately...
But you saw his throne. You saw the back of Thanos' throne floating in the air. So.
This movie legitimately made me afraid for all these characters going into Infinity War.
Tony Stark ain't making it out of Infinity War.
Oh, no! I'm seriously going to be upset if they go.
And it's a credit to Marvel. It's a credit to my heart. He's become so intertwined with this. He is this Avengers... Even though it might be short-sighted, and depending on where you fall in the Tony Stark versus Captain America mindset argument, none of this happens without him. He is this franchise, man.
Yes.
I mean, he's become, and it's what it's done for Robert Downey Jr.'s career outside the movies. I mean, it's going to hurt so much to see him die.
And we've said it, like, we'd love to see Suri from Black Panther become
100%.
A Tony Stark or take the role, but we want Tony off on an island somewhere having fun with Pepper Potts starting a family. Yeah, we don't want him to die. Yeah. This is what we really think. So,
suck.
There's a lot of plot here. The whole MCU is kind of brought into this movie, which is fun in a way, because now we get tentpole understanding from Marvel. They really know this is going to be the big movie that they bring all the cameos in. So you got Nick Fury, you got Tony and Thor arguing about Jane and Pepper. You got Loki's staff with the Infinity Stone for Vision. You're setting up, slowly but surely, Black Panther with Ulysses' claw. So you got a ton of cameos, S.H.I.E.L.D., like I said, coming in to save the day.
You have one-off scenes, whether they become flashbacks and fear, like Thor's being choked by Heimdall, so Idris Elba makes an appearance.
Right.
Anthony Mackie's Falcon plays a small role. I mean, everybody that we've been introduced to so far, save the Guardians, who are still floating out in space,
right,
are here in one way or another. Yeah, so the budget, naturally, for this movie is probably the highest one Marvel has had yet.
So now you have one of the first non-villain superhero deaths in this movie, with Quicksilver eventually dying.
I thought that was kind of cheap.
So he was bad, then he became good,
right.
And all right. But I thought Elizabeth Olsen acted the heck out of that scene. It was really cool to see her show of power reaction shot. I thought,
drop the accents.
Oh yeah, maybe.
I just,
you know, her, what she's doing with her face there.
Yeah, no, she's a great actress in her own right, and yeah, I'm totally with you. She was very. She played fear very well, too. When Hawkeye has to kind of give her a motivational speech, she'd be like, look, you're either fighting or you're here, but you can't do both.
I was impressed with her.
I'm excited. And she's Scarlet Witch, for those of you that do know the comic, she's a very intricate piece of things that could happen going forward. She's Magneto's daughter in the comics, as Quicksilver was his son. So now that the X-Men property is, I think, owned by Disney again, that might have something to do. There's a whole storyline called House of M where Scarlet Witch freaks out and resets the entire universe.
Oh, my God.
Which they could play as a card once these Avengers and have had their Phase 7, like you said.
Whoop!
So, yeah, there's a lot of possibilities there.
So what I wanted to ask you is, you know, I wanted to quote a very prestigious movie of my upbringing, Ace Ventura, When Nature Calls.
The music video, Mbop, by Hanson.
Three darts is too much. Was this too much, this whole plot line? Was this too many characters? Was it too much blockbusterness?
There's an argument to be made, because of course, there's a lot to pack in. But, like we keep saying, what Marvel does well and DC needs to improve on, they've established these characters. So if you're going to give a guy like Falcon one scene, or if you're going to give Heimdall a flashback and he's in this movie for 30 seconds maybe total, right, you at least know. I mean, you could create a familiarity and a backstory and understand the gravity of what's happening because you see him there and you see him choking Thor. That's not supposed to be what's going on. Like, because you know Heimdall already. You know Heimdall's just and noble and blah, blah, blah. So is there too many people on screen at the time? You can make the argument, but at least they've already established these people. They're not introducing, stuffing a bunch of new characters. Quicksilver is given time to develop. I kind of have problems with him dying at the end, but that's a different argument. Scarlet Witch is given time to develop. She's an Avenger now. Nobody else is really new. Everyone else we've seen, at least a little bit. So I didn't have a problem with it personally.
So I'm going to talk structurally after we do Civil War on comparing this movie with Civil War, which is basically Avengers 3.
And yes, and that was going to be my other argument, too, that I didn't pursue. But
okay.
So the Avengers are supposed to be the party. You know, the Avengers movies is when everybody's supposed to be brought back together.
Now, yes.
The argument against that is that Captain America, Civil War, they come back again.
Yeah,
so
see,
that
we
might
do
be
whatever
exposure.
We want.
Yeah.
We like billions of dollars. Come
exactly.
back to us.
Yeah. Exactly. So maybe if you're going to be doing it in random Captain America movies and random Iron Man movies, maybe it is too much. But if you're only going to bring everyone back for these big Avengers movies, then I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I thought Joss Whedon still pulls it together. I wonder if he made a one plot switch that they will make in Civil War, if it could have been a better movie. But I'll kind of, again, I'll touch on that in our next episode. That's a teaser,
excited.
Folks.
I'm very excited.
That's a teaser. So yeah, best scenes. Like I said, Ultron looked great. What do you think, Mike?
Yeah, I loved Ultron. I loved the depth of his character too. And like we keep saying, this MCU seems to have a bit of a villain problem.
Right.
Because all the best Marvel villains are attached to like the Spider-Man and the X-Men and those properties, and not necessarily the Iron Man and the Captain America's.
Right, and he's manipulative. He has a plan all along, and that plan is sans humans, and he's basically winning humans over to enact his plan, kind of because he needs them.
And it's deep. So it's a layered plan, too. He wants humans to evolve. He thinks the only way to evolve is to recreate yourself, basically, to build from the ground. So
it works.
Layers there. I like the Ultron villain. I like the clothed Avengers fight scene at the very beginning when Ultron's introducing himself.
Yes.
And the Avengers are having their party or whatever.
Love the party scene.
Plot device.
Thor's
you
hammer.
Talk
yeah. And then once the captain moves it a little bit and Thor's
freaking
out.
That was funny. I have less love for this movie than I did. I'm less amped about it than I was for Guardians. Again, the second in the trilogy is always tough to pull off. I think the thing I like most or my best about this movie is knowing there's a payoff coming in Civil War and Avengers. Like, Tony keeps screwing up and he keeps losing himself. He's slipping a little bit more and more. And we know that's going to come to a head. Like, Captain's not going to just keep looking the other way with him. There's going to be a penance.
I love your read on it, because it's my read as well. Because I think the story with the most teeth is the Civil War setup.
Right.
It's the Iron Man and Hulk fight, which might be one of my favorite action scenes of the decade. I don't know if it's one of the best, because it does get a little cartoonish there. I love Hulk. I love big robot monsters fighting real monsters.
Yes.
I watched Godzilla versus Mechagodzilla as a kid.
Oh, wow.
This, to me, was worth the price of admission. That battle was worth the price of admission right there. It was harrowing, and it was freaking you out. It's going to have repercussions down the road. And I thought their budget was well spent on that. It was one of the coolest things in the MCU thus far.
Yeah.
All of Tony's innovations to try and stop Hulk, it was just brilliant. Because it was one thing after a next, all failing miserably, and just a crazy-ass fight. Tony in as much jeopardy as he's been in.
Yeah.
Having to deal with Hulk. Black Widow nowhere to be found.
We're gonna lose him. He keeps getting in more and more trouble and just escaping, and he's just going to get in trouble and not escape.
So I think the Hulk Iron Man fight was a bigger set piece than the finale. And let me say for the record, I realize that screenwriting formulas have the magical midpoint, the mid act two centerpiece of your story. That's usually your biggest set piece. I get it. And it was in other movies. It was in The Dark Knight, for example, more so than the finale. The finale is more about posing dilemmas to your key characters, right?
Right.
this movie kind of goes overboard with that concept, making a bigger finale, just trying to one-up. So sometimes the bigger finale doesn't work necessarily. Winter Soldier kind of did work for me, whereas this one didn't work as well with the whole city in the sky.
So you had a problem with the meteor in general, with the meteor
plan? Well, remember,
plan, or?
Remember I said you should have escalating spectacle?
Right.
And I think that on retrospect, thinking back to it, sometimes that works better, sometimes it doesn't. Like The Dark Knight to me really worked well when I rewatched it recently. There's a lot of alliteration again there. Fans are going wild. I think it works in something like The Dark Knight. And you can go one way with it where you can go be smaller in terms of spectacle, right? And just be posing difficult dilemmas to your heroes and to the public like it did in The Dark Knight. Or you can kind of go bigger and, again, just heighten up the drama interpersonally. Regardless, whether you go bigger or smaller in the final set piece, you got to heighten up the drama for your key characters. I don't know if they could have done that. I don't think they necessarily did do that. I think the height of the drama in this movie is, like you said, the Civil War plotline. It's Tony versus Hulk. It's the Avengers coming apart. That was the best stuff.
Yeah, I had less of a problem, though, with my interpretation being that Ultron is an offshoot of Tony's mindset. That's basically what he is. He comes from Tony. He says that a couple times in the movie. And he's an amalgamation of Tony's fear.
But
and
was there any doubt that they're going to save the world again? That's like the thing at
well,
the end.
I mean,
you know,
that's not fair. No, because this is the 11th movie and we have seven more to, you know, I mean, that's.
Right, but we know we're worried Hulk might kill Iron Man. And I think Marvel understood rewatching that and reexamining their own story here. Yeah, we need to make a change. We need to take a break from the usual save the world storyline. Because even Guardians of the Galaxy winds up being that.
Mm-hmm.
And we, even though it did it in a funny way, it's kind of a spoof on it, parody of it. We need to go in a different direction. And DC kind of copycatted them afterwards or piggybacked on that idea and
so
did it wrong.
Are you saying you would have rather the movie had the big, we're all circled around the control for the meteor by battling all these robots? Would you have rather that been the only, he never got in the city up in the sky actually? Or what would you have ended?
When we break down the Civil War plot line, I'm going to tell you what I'd rather have seen happen. But okay. for this review, I will say that I like the centerpiece fight more than the finale, the Iron Man Hulk fight more than the finale. And I think Marvel, in reexamining and looking at themselves, putting a harsh look at themselves, said, okay, that's where we need to go next. Because it was so strong in this film. I think
I was a big fan of that scene that I just described, though, where Scarlet Witch finally buys in and all the Avengers are circling. Battling all the robots. That was awesome.
So, yeah, the finale. So let's break down the finale a little bit. It had some great moments to it, correct?
I mean, the seeing all the Avengers and that, the camera. I don't know what the hell you even describe it as, whether it's visual effects or camera work or what. But when that one tracking shot where it's moving around in the circle while every Avenger is handling a robot in a different way and they're working together in slow-mo, too. I don't know how the hell they pulled it off. That looked beautiful. That was so well done.
Avengers beating up henchmen, all their best moves, like in the beginning sequence, and then in this sequence was pretty awesome. I love, I have a problem, even in films and in life, of course, with heights at times. So this movie, gave me vertigo.
Right.
Just watching it on my couch where I forget.
That car's going to fall off the meteor.
Oh, my God. I forget who was hanging for their life in this movie, but it was scary.
There was a couple. I mean, Captain saved the driver, and Thor had to go down and save the other car. It was a couple times,
The finale really works, I thought, because they kind of talk about all of Ultron's capabilities. He's got many capabilities. He can escape through the internet. He can do this. He can do that. And they kind of check off all the boxes during that finale, working it all together. From his big plan to his escape plan.
Yeah, I have a problem with a computer program being so self-aware and not being self-aware enough to where it maybe shouldn't put its entire being into one last robot. He's a computer program. Wouldn't he just recede back into the internet and find a new
home?
Yeah,
isn't he stronger being in the internet?
Yeah, that was a little wishy-washy. But I really like the ending with Vision was on the last one. Vision and Ultron have their discussion of basically how they see the world. I thought that was kind of cool.
It was cool.
I have a couple worse scenes. You want to get into those? Could have done without the whole cheesy 1930s flirting love story between Natasha and Bruce Banner at the beginning, where Cap comes in with his, just don't wait, man. Yeah, if I have one piece of advice, don't wait too long.
It didn't work great.
Thanks, like, why, guy we, from the 1920s.
We got Black Widow. Why do we gotta make a flirtation out of it? Nah. Like, just let her be awesome.
I didn't mind the love story. It's just that, like, why don't just?
No, I think it's reducing her impact. Like,
it does
why do
a
we?
Little bit. You're right. I just, didn't even think of that, but you're right.
I do think it reduces her impact. Like, on the plot, she is just the Hulk Whisperer in this one until she fails being the Hulk Whisperer, and then without really going through any deep shit. She succeeds at the end and with a line of dialogue telling Hulk to get it back into the fight, which is not, it's not an arc. That doesn't work. And you're just totally misusing her.
I would have rather they just had a title card at the beginning of the movie that said Hawkeye is really important instead of doing what they did in this whole derivative story.
I want to flip my whole computer around right now and show you just in big letters, The Farm.
What the fuck? I mean, that was terrible.
It was bad. I mean, yes, the movie needs an oasis. It needs
sure.
You need that to give yourself a break after the trauma of the quote Ulysses Claw, whatever, on the boat sequence that was fighting Scarlet Witch for the first time, messing with their heads. Okay, I get it.
But who among us is buying the narrative that Hawkeye is the most important Avenger? Yeah, they need you. They're your team. You got to be there for them. Like, his wife's pumping him up. First of all, best wife ever.
Right.
For bending the truth that way and telling her husband what he needs to hear. But come on, man.
Yeah, I mean,
he's Hawkeye.
You're too convincing in that sequence. They should have. Like, Hawkeye should stay home.
They should have
like,
stuck. They should have stuck with him being the wisecracky one. The one where he's like, when he's talking to Scarlet Witch on the battlefield, being like, "I'm shooting a bow and arrow. None of this makes any sense." Like, that was fine. I'm fine with that being Hawkeye, but. Don't have him be the emotional support of the group.
Like, they all in that scene, after that sequence, they all should have been like, yeah, I mean, listen, you help us, but you don't help us enough to where we want to risk your family's well-being, so stay home, dude.
Watch your kids grow up.
Yeah, watch your kids grow up. Like, we didn't know you had all this. Like, how do the Avengers...
That's a really good point.
How do they have the peace of mind to live with themselves?
We can't do this.
No, you need to stay here. You need to stay home. They should have had a huge blowout argument. Yes, the farm is... a place where Tony and Chris Evans as Cap there, they can have round two of their kind of pre-Civil War debate in a way. Yeah. But yeah, I'm not a fan. Quicksilver seems a bit underutilized, I would say, after how he was showcased in another form in X-Men Apocalypse.
I was fine with this performance.
He does a lot, but it's just...
And he's a good guy. You're rooting for him for less than half the movie, and then he's dead. And if you want to kill the first Avenger, don't have it be that one.
But Marvel had to be kicking themselves when they saw the Fox.
Yeah.
You know, Quicksilver.
Oh, shit, that's how you do it.
That's good. Yeah. So, I mean, I don't like X-Men Apocalypse overall.
Well, you're an idiot.
I thought the movie failed.
Yeah, you're a bad person.
But that was the highlight. That was the oasis of X-Men Apocalypse.
Got any other worse scenes?
So Hulk is underutilized in this movie as well. Like, I get... that they had the big scene with him in the middle, but like in the finale, he's just, oh, he's back to normal now. But then he's not. And then,
you know. If you're going to make Hulk go away and sulk on a jet to nowhere, how do you not play the Hulk theme? The Hulk going away theme?
It's just like missed opportunities. It's too much to do that they can't do it all.
Yeah.
When they go and build everything up too strong, they don't have time for the resolutions. And show the slow curtain because they just don't have time. It's just too much. So that's, I guess I would err on the side of it's a bit too much for one movie, and that's where I land on this one, even though it's still a lot of fun. There's a lot of goods delivered.
If S.H.I.E.L.D. disbanded, where did Nick Fury find all the capable staff to run a helicarrier?
Well, he's got that group of super loyal, proven themselves now people. Like
don't,
the guy,
don't they have regular jobs they have to be at?
Probably.
They all call in sick?
All the big names and the likable S.H.I.E.L.D. people from the last movie, right? The guy who was willing to die at this control panel. And
I understand that's me thinking too much about it. You got any other scenes?
That's it.
Yeah, that was it for me, too. Just two more post-credit scenes real quick. We see Thanos getting his gloves saying, "I'll do it myself." That was awesome. And Stan Lee cameo, he's at the party, he's an old war vet, takes some liquor from Asgard, gets knocked on his ass.
Yeah.
Excelsior.
That was funny.
That was funny.
Oscar lens, I mean, no best visual effects, as we said. What the fuck again? Bridge of Spies was nominated for Best Picture, Michael.
Yeah.
Bridge of Spies.
Yeah.
So this year it was totally mangled. I know Ultron is not like the cross I want to bear for a Best Picture nom necessarily. Like I said, Guardians should be the year before, yeah. But just mangled.
I didn't have really any of the big seven I could have fit in. You could do James Spader, but again, that would be the same argument as the Rocket Raccoon one. So
they're all supporting characters in this movie because there's no really protagonist. So yeah, I also didn't.
And like you said, the plot was a little convoluted.
But here's the thing, like. Technical nominations. Where were they?
Yeah, that's ridiculous. That's absolutely ridiculous.
Fucking number one, they screwed it up regardless because Mad Max should have beaten Ex Machina. But you're telling me Bridge of Spies had better production design than Age of Ultron? Are you kidding me?
It's almost as if they deduct points for the things you get wrong, which shouldn't be how it is. If you take the chances enough times to work these kinds of effects and sets into your practical sets and your visual effects and stuff like that, you should be rewarded for if you pull it off.
It's like saying your hometown Little League team plays better baseball than the Yankees.
Yes.
Because your $10 million movie...
Well, you've never seen my Little League team, though, so... Okay. Is this the best three-movie stretch in the MCU? Guardians of the Galaxy, Ultron?
Good question. It might be.
Might be, yeah. I'm not sure myself, but it's got to be up there.
It's not because of what's to come, but so far, yeah.
All right, fair enough.
Because I think the last stretch is pretty good. Black Panther, Thor, Ragnarok, Spider-Man, Homecoming.
Yeah.
Well.
See you by skip. Winter Soldier, Guardians 1, Avengers 1.
Oh! Oh! Oh, no! Yeah. Oh, no! How?
Well, you got to do it. You got to do it.
I really loved all three. Ugh. Like a year ago, I would have said Winter Soldier would have been the skip, but rewatching Winter Soldier, I'm so thrilled because I had one of those just irrational hate because of Hydra. I've had this for a long time.
Right.
Well, at this stage, I still will see Guardians of the Galaxy. I ignored Winter Soldier for too long, so I would like to study that more. I would have to skip the Avengers 1.
Whoa!
Yeah, there's no right answer.
Dang!
You give an answer. You're supposed to.
I would buy Guardians. I would see Winter Soldier.
No!
I would skip the Avengers too. Not a man of principle. I just like yelling.
That's funny. So here I am going into Ant-Man, and I've lost the fire a little bit, so maybe you got to help me get it back here, Mike.
Yeah, I'm with you. It was, you know, Ultron was what it was, and we were robbed of a couple nominations. So number 12, we're going to finish off with Ant-Man.
So we're like spent after Ultron, so maybe we need to come down a little bit. Anyway, Ant-Man cast and crew, written by Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish. Now that's going to start to get my engines going a little bit. I'm trying to hype myself up. Written and botched by Paul Rudd and Marvel here, I think. I would have much rather seen the Wright-Cornish movie. I think you needed their style and their Wright's direction to really pull
it off. Well, you supposedly had a good deal of Edgar Wright was involved with this movie up to a point. So
other writing credits, they tried to salvage things with Rudd. They gave a credit to Adam McKay. It's totally too many cooks in the kitchen. Talk about that song, The Sound of Settling, directed by Peyton Reed from Bring It On, The Breakup, and Yes Man.
Because when I saw Bring It On, the first thing I thought of...
Yeah, he should have more money to make movies.
He
should have more monies to make Bring It On, too. Like, that Bring It On was kind of fun, actually. But
I like Bring It On.
That beloved...
But I didn't think superhero Ant-Man the first time I saw Bring It On.
The Breakup is kind of one of the more disappointing rom-coms ever. And Yes Man was just a total fart in the wind. I mean, it was just, who cares?
Yeah.
All right.
No arguments.
Starring Paul Rudd as Scott Lang, Michael Douglas as Basil Exposition, Evangeline Lilly as Hope Van Dyne, Corey Stoll from House of Cards, and Corey Stoll with hair on The Strain, Stoll as Darren Cross / Yellow Jacket.
He was good.
Bobby Cannavale as Paxton, Judy Greer as Maggie Lang, Michael Pena as Luis, Anthony Mackie has a great cameo as Falcon, and T.I. is Dave. Ant-Man box office. Budget was $130. Why couldn't they give that to Black Widow? What are we doing?
Yeah, well, I'm with you. But also, you just said Avengers was like $260 or something like that. So we're cutting it in half for this movie.
Going smaller. And
should be.
Domestic earnings, $180. International earnings, $339. So that's a worldwide total of $519.3 million.
This made a half a billion dollars. This is the movie where you knew, okay, Marvel can do no wrong. This movie had no hype, barely any hype, barely any expectations. It still raked in $500 million.
Ant-Man critical reception, Rotten Tomatoes, 82%, 6.8 out of 10 critic score.
Sure.
86%, 4 out of 5 audience rating. IMDb is 7.3 rating out of 419,000 votes. Cinema score was an A, Michael.
Really?
Metacritic was a 64. So, production nuggets, I got three here.
Yep.
Howard Stern tried to buy the rights to this story in 2000.
That would have been interesting.
That is true. Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish, they were involved starting in 2003. They were on board, being interviewed, blogging about this for 12 years. They turned in 5 drafts of the script. Down the line in 2015, after everything's greenlit, after they're jumping through hoops to accommodate Edgar Wright making The World's End before he can make this movie, mm-hmm. as they were flirting with him in terms of setting a production date while he was doing Scott Pilgrim, and then again while he was doing World's End. So it's kind of inconvenient. Every time Marvel wants to do it, he's doing something else every time. So it's like really awkward. Now, Marvel finally says, we're rewriting the script. And Edgar Wright basically goes, screw you guys, I'm going
home. Deuces!
Yeah. Yep. So that was it. Huge disappointment.
Yeah.
Marvel is taken aback by this, it seems, because they really stumble and bumble. They try to get Paul Rudd and Adam McKay really to take charge. Adam McKay's like, nope, not going to do it. It's too Edgar Wright.
Right.
So like I said, Peyton Reed is the choice. They were thinking about giving Peyton Reed a movie before this. I don't know
why.
This
sounds like a bunch of Marvel posturing, too, because over a 15-year period or so, if you really wanted Edgar Wright to helm this movie, you probably could have found time for Edgar Wright to helm this movie.
You could have figured it out. I understand once you're responsible for all the stockholders making billion-dollar investments for billion-dollar properties.
Yeah, but by the time Scott Pilgrim was happening, show me a movie that Edgar Wright had flubbed. You knew it was going to be find an audience. It was going to have a niche somewhere.
And they believed in it enough, his storyline enough to keep mm-hmm. to keep it, right? I just think it needed Edgar Wright for execution. Like, it's all so tonal.
Sounds like Marvel didn't want him. That's my take of it.
And when you read about this project and you read about all the stylistic things he was going to do with like 70s TV shows and like the flashback to Michael Douglas's character, it really didn't work for me. Yeah. So awards, it got a BAFTA nomination for Best Visual Effects.
Wow.
It won Best Comic to Film Adaptation at the Academy of Science Fiction Awards, and it was nominated for a bunch of other stuff, but it's kind of a smaller movie, like we said. Didn't get a lot of awards. So that's all I got. Any plot premise?
Yeah, let's do a quick plot premise for Ant-Man. Hank Pym is a genius scientist because 90% of people in the MCU are. He's perfected the ability for humans to shrink in size using a unique suit. The suit is his life's work, even though it is basically responsible for costing him his wife when they both worked as heroes for S.H.I.E.L.D., she was called the Wasp, and also has cost him his relationship with his daughter, Hope. Not wanting the technology to fall into the wrong hands, and seeing the potential dangers both to whomever wears the suit and others who encounter the man in said suit, Pym decides to hide the technology away from the world. That is, until his former protege and Hope's current boss, Darren Cross, reveals that he too has perfected the technology decades later and is willing to sell to the highest bidder. That highest bidder is Hydra. There they are.
Meh.
Hope, having mended her relationship with Pym, unbeknownst to Cross, implores her father to let her wear the suit in order to shut down Cross's version of the suit, referred to as the Yellow Jacket. Pym, though, has already lost one family member and is beyond hesitant to lose another, thus he finds a man less valuable to himself with the capabilities and criminal record of being a prominent thief already, Scott Lang. Thus, it is Lang who becomes the Ant-Man and, after a few montages of combat training by Hope, as well as technology introduced to him by Pym, must infiltrate Cross's lab and destroy the Yellow Jacket's suit. Though Lang is able to infiltrate with help of his friends and former heist team, Michael Pena's Louise, T.I.'s Dave, and David Dasmalsian's Kurt, my apologies if I got
that name wrong. Dasmalsian sounds right.
It's Cross who sees the wannabe Avenger coming, and it all leads to a size-changing, perspective-skipping fight between the two for the suit, the technology, basically the world, but more importantly than anything, for Lang's young daughter, Cassie. That's where we are in this movie. So we have less stakes. They explain away the Avengers, right, which is kind of, I thought was kind of cool.
Yep.
Scott Lang basically says, why aren't you calling the Avengers for this? And we see the history of Pym and Elder Stark, Tony's dad, talking about why it didn't work out and Pym didn't want him to have the technology, so he's not going to ask his son to help him, blah, blah, blah. That was kind of cool.
That was the one Michael Douglas thing I liked about this. But basically, the only important scene for the quote-unquote MCU is when he goes to the Avengers home base and steals some tech, and you have the fight with the Falcon there, Anthony Mackie.
Yeah, so part of the movie, a big part of the tech is that they need this refractor energizer, I don't know what you call it, from what is supposed to be an abandoned warehouse on Stark property in upstate New York, except when Lang gets there, it's not an abandoned warehouse, it's an Avengers training facility.
Right.
And you have the very poetic battle of the ant fighting the bird that wants to kill him. You have Ant-Man fighting Falcon, which was really cool. I thought that was one of my better scenes.
In my opinion, the worst introduction to a character scene of the MCU in the prison punch off with the guy they're mad at each other. No, they're friends. Come on.
You had to though, because the expectations were so low for this, and this movie isn't.
But that scene sucked. That's what I'm saying.
But it's not your Avengers movie. Yeah, it's not good, but you have to start on a joke because this movie is basically a lot of jokes.
How about we start on a joke that works?
Yeah, I don't disagree. I don't disagree.
I thought the Michael Pena and the boys, that group of knuckleheads were funny. Where we're legitimately,
I was crushing it.
Legitimately funny.
Michael Pena is always funny when he's allowed to be funny. Yeah, I agree.
To me, my biggest thing about this film, my thesis statement is going to be this really picks up at the midpoint. And once you get into the finale, end of the second and the third act, this is a fun movie. But it takes a long while. And upon rewatch, I even put it on the other day as I was doing other stuff. On my laptop, and I like just couldn't watch it until the middle of the movie. It was almost like a test of what I'm just saying right now, because I rewatched it and then I put it on again to maybe get more familiar, and I really didn't perk up until the middle.
The three lead males in this movie, Michael Douglas, Paul Rudd, Bobby Cannavale, I couldn't care less about. The only character I had interest in, or I guess you could say Cross in there too, the only character I had interested in was Evangeline Lilly. Sure. I hope Van Dyke is the most interesting character in this movie.
And they figured that much out, too, because Ant-Man and the Wasp is coming. But
right.
I'm sincerely worried going in with this character after the first half, because Paul Rudd is not charismatic. He's not funny. It's missing.
Ooh.
It's missing for the first half of the movie, in my opinion. I think his friends are funnier than him. So this is like screenwriting books or whatever, everything that I think is right in the world in terms of writing.
Are you judging this? But
everybody tells you, I'm sorry, I just got to get this out because I'm trying to figure. Everybody tells you don't give the movie away to the auxiliary characters. And that's what this movie kind of does for the first half.
So are you judging your enjoyment of this movie based on the screenwriting aspect of it or basing on what you just see in front of you as far as the story goes?
I'm upset that the jokes don't work in the first half. It's just like force, like, see, you got to like this guy, see, you know, and again, it's like Jerry Bruckheimer-ish, this wrongfully accused, or correctly accused because he's Robin Hood and is a thief, and all right, come on.
Yeah, that was one of my worst scenes. He was just stealing from people that could afford to be stolen from.
Of my worst scenes in this movie involve Michael Douglas. I don't even have to really mention them all because it's just the Michael Douglas character.
You have more hate for this movie than I do, I think.
I just think the Michael Douglas character is the worst character the MCU has ever written because he's such a plot device.
Wow, you are saying some things about this
movie. He's such a plot device. Rewatching it was painful because Michael Douglas's character should have an ant on his fucking nose every scene. The whole movie, because it should be a metaphor, which is not really a metaphor, of how on the nose his dialogue is. It's just terrible.
He's Ant-Man, and this is my boss, Ant-Nose.
I wish I figured out this tech years ago, because, by the way, did I tell you the story about my wife?
Yeah.
It's needed the most.
Shoehorned in.
Come on.
What'd you think about the subatomic storyline?
I mean, listen. So once the second half kicks in, I really like it, and I like the actual
subatomic stuff.
Flash black. I buy the subatomic stuff. I mean, it's scary, right? Little horror.
You would
in
think
there.
They would have more explanation as to if you're going to enter the void that Homer Simpson enters in that Treehouse of Horror episode.
Yeah,
I'm in a place where I don't know where I am. You'd think it would have more explanation to it, but yeah, I thought it was cool.
So we get into best scenes.
It definitely brings some seriousness to the character, so.
Yes, I mean, we've been harsh. I've been harsh. But I do have some.
Yes, all right, so let's see. After you take a hearty dump all over this movie.
The montages with Michael Pena are the game of telephone that they play
yes.
in wonderfully enjoyable editing that would have been even better if Edgar Wright did it. That's very, very funny. It's very playful. I love the stuff with the shrink and the make it big technology. Like, I feel like whenever they do that stuff, it's fun. I'm like, they're just
and
Marvel
that's the biggest
playing.
Shame of it is that this Ant-Man character is like really cool and is capable of doing some really cool stuff. And I could see it being a huge weapon for the Avengers going forward.
And I'm a huge fan of the finale. I think that them having the fight on their daughter on his daughter's train set is hysterical.
Loved it.
And it's a little scary because the Yellow Jacket's a cool-looking villain with a lot of power there.
It was something I expected, and I'm really glad to see it happen. When you're in the perspective when there are the size of ants, all the seriousness that's going on, but then you fade out to real time, and it's just like a toy train set coming towards them that skips.
So now, to be honest, that is 100% a South Park gag, or maybe it's not a South Park gag. From fifth, we've watched every episode of South Park. We've had that laugh before at a South Park episode from 15 years ago. I can't picture it in my head.
Which is why I expected it, but I'm still glad it was handled.
Yeah, they probably stole it from Monty Python, so whatever. Right. It works. So yeah, I thought it was really funny. I thought it was harrowing. I love the big Thomas the Tank Engine. I love the giant ant. So it's funny. I loved all the ant stuff with the heist part of the movie. The end of Act 2 is a heist sequence, and all the ant stuff, which they built up fairly well from the midpoint on, I really enjoyed that. I thought that was super cool, kind of gross, but kind of fun. Michael Peña and the boys got to, help him out, and it was fun. So I get mad at this movie, but there's a lot of fun to be had from halfway point on.
Yeah, this is how I described it when we first sat down. This is the kids' movie of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, which is fine. I mean, it serves its purpose. You could see a lot of stuff tailored to a younger audience, a lot of humor tailored to the younger audience. Hey, you got to get them when they're young too, right? I mean, those are who's telling their parents to buy the toys, so why not?
Yeah, but Evangeline Lilly and Paul Rudd characters, those two characters' development doesn't really work for their romance.
I mean, I could have done without the romance altogether.
But it doesn't. Yeah, why? Yeah, just because he's supposed to kiss the female lead.
Could have done without that. The Evangeline Lilly, the training montages I thought were awesome, where she's just kicking his ass for like 20 minutes throughout it, trying to teach him how to fight. Because you do have this guy that's just a thief. You have to basically, if you're going to make him a superhero, you got to build him from the ground up.
So many missed opportunities.
But it brings up the question, why not just give the suit to Evangeline Lilly anyway? If she has to do, I understand you don't want to lose her, but if she has to do all the fucking training.
Think about how many jokes the Michael Douglas character could have had, both serious jokes and real jokes during that training montage. And he could have just been like, well, I don't care if you die. I mean, that whole thing was played so seriously when it should have been, funny. Like Guardians of the Galaxy was on that tonal knife its whole movie. And you give Peyton Reed, who's a wet carrot of a director, you don't give him, you don't actually.
You have said because
Edgar Wright is I would be a disciple.
You love Edgar Wright.
I would be a disciple in his cult. Yes. After Baby Driver, after the Cornetto trilogy, not so much Scott Pilgrim, but I would be a disciple.
Oh my
in an
God!
Edgar Wright
like
cult. No, I don't. I don't. I don't like Scott Pilgrim.
This has been a revealing 20 minutes.
Yes.
So my favorite scenes you've hit, my favorite one overall, though, was the briefcase flying through the sky once they both fall out of the helicopter, and the Cross says very shoehorned into the script, I'm going to disintegrate you! And Siri starts playing Disintegration by The Cure.
Yeah, that
and
was
then
funny.
We have the inside fighting and then the outside of a briefcase flying through the sky. That made me laugh hardest, so that was my favorite scene.
Yes, very good.
Worst scenes, go ahead.
Well, the Michael Douglas stuff, obviously.
Yes.
Paul Rudd's terrible in the first half of this movie. It's like he's almost...
terrible.
He's terrible because he's almost like held back. Like he's not trying to be a movie star. Or he's trying too hard to act cool for the first half. Like it really didn't work for me until they get into the fun of games of the middle. He starts to perk up a little bit.
Cancel Paul Rudd?
As an actor. And here's the thing about Paul Rudd. I love him as an actor, and from the midpoint on, he's very good. He's very good as a voice actor when he's doing that part of it, and he is terrific later on as a cameo kind of guy, as a role player in the next movie. So they will make him work. Some growing pains.
I think
pains.
Your overall point some growing that pains. You said at the beginning of this, where why are you making this and not a Black Widow solo movie, kind of hits home hardest. Because if you had this money to spend, if Paul Rudd's going to be just a supporting player going forward, then obviously, Black Widow is one of your main pieces.
Captain Marvel earlier, Black Widow already set up. Like, this, it's just dumb.
Makes, yeah.
But you have to go through 45 minutes of growing pains to get to anything good in this movie, in my opinion. So that's the problem.
The scene with the mother, the original Wasp, I thought that was, if it's the whole basis for Michael Douglas's mindset, well, you can't do more than just have a line of dialogue about it. Like, yeah, we were on a ship. She went subatomic. She's dead. Oh, okay.
No, it's, I'm going to tell you right before you have to, you know, siege the
right
the heist part
with
of
no
Act
preface,
two.
No context.
This is the, yeah, yeah. Come on,
that was
it was terribly written.
And the only other big complaint I have, because it was a very, you're right, it's a very mediocre movie. It's a kids' movie. How is Cross able to work the yellow jacket suit so flawlessly?
Yeah, with no
We had the entire movie. Again, it's the problem Iron Man had too. The entire movie is you learning how to use this technology, and you're fighting a bad guy that is a master at it when he first puts it on.
Yeah, he just cracked the code of the tech.
Right. I don't understand that.
They just
at all.
Showed, you know, all that time go by. That was like a couple weeks worth where, you know, Paul Rudd's learning how to use it. Finally, you know, giving his character some freaking life.
Yeah, like, there's a lot of things I own that I don't know how to use. He doesn't know how to use it just because he owns it. Give us something here. Let us know he's a karate master at least or something.
Yeah, I'm with you. Oscar Lenz?
Nothing.
Yeah, not an Oscar movie. I'm not even going to stretch for the Big Seven.
You can't say it's a script. You can't say any performance.
In a very bad week year, maybe best visual effects.
No.
But
if you're not nominating Avengers or Guardians.
Right. I think this movie becomes a popcorn success by the end, like I've said 1,000 times now. I think Peña and the Boys should have been used later on, and I'm very upset that they haven't been used since.
Oh, that breaks my heart. I didn't know that.
Sorry.
It's not a spoiler if it doesn't happen.
Right. Anti-spoiler. Yeah. No.
Also, Jesus doesn't come down in the Civil War.
I'm sure Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to use them, so we'll see.
Stan Lee cameo and final scene, Luis is telling another game of telephone. Anna Kana was actually in that one, whose work I love on YouTube, telling about how Falcon wants to see the Ant-Man again to talk to him about the Avengers, or at least fight him. And Stan Lee was one of the chains in the telephone link there. He's a bartender. Har har. Waited till the very end of the movie to get him in, though, which was the first time that's happened.
Right.
Two post-credit scenes. One is Pym shows Hope a new Wasp suit, which is bringing up, it's already been announced, Ant-Man and the Wasp is going to be coming out this summer, I think. After Avengers Infinity War. Second post-credit scene is the setup for Civil War. We're shown a piece of Civil War. Captain America and Falcon see a disheveled and beaten up Bucky Barnes, and they're arguing about whether or not to tell Tony and saying that he won't understand.
Yeah, so two essential scenes in this movie. Paul Rudd and Falcon, and then the post-credit.
Yeah,
that's all you need.
That's where it fits in the MCU. You're absolutely right. So that's it. We're on. We have Civil War next. That's where we are.
Yeah!
The big, big tentpole. If the Avengers was one and maybe Guardians was two, you could argue Avengers 2 was another, but here we are. Civil War. We're all going to do some infighting. And to celebrate, Mike and I are going to have a fist fight live on air before our next podcast recording.
It won't last very long. It'll be like the South Park Cartman getting hit by Kyle.
Both get out of breath.
So that's what happened. But basically, these next three movies are on Netflix for you to stream now. So if you haven't been watching them along with us, maybe this next, you know, number five, you got Guardians 2, you got Doctor Strange, and Civil War. I think that's going backwards. I don't know the order of things again.
I think it goes Civil War, but Guardians, Strange. I think
you're right.
Yeah. So yeah, definitely check those out. Check these out. Let us know how you've been liking these episodes, these MCU reviews. We're trying to get these done before Infinity War. We have our fingers crossed, and we're really doing all we can there. So God willing, this will be done next week. You can go into Infinity War and get it all set. You'll be an MCU master.
You will be.
Or at least you'll know what the hell's going on.
It'd be fun. You know, between your fourth and fifth theater going experiences of Infinity War, you should be listening to our podcast.
Yeah. And even if you have no interest, listen to us. What are you doing?
Yeah. What are you
doing? Got time.
Perfect pitch at the end of a longest episode. That's a great job by us.
Just kidding. We know you truly, we do, void. As always, love and appreciate every single listener and fan that we have. And if you want to interact with us about this or any of our episodes or any upcoming movies or ones that we have reviewed in the past, we are Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Instagram, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Facebook, MM and Oscar on Twitter, Mike, Mike, and Oscar on Reddit, Mike, Mike, and Oscar.com, Mike, Mike, and Oscar at gmail.com. Reach out to us. Let us know. Feel free to subscribe on iTunes. Give us a like. Give us a follow. You can rate us. You can leave us a comment there.
All that stuff stuff kind of helps. It definitely helps.
Truly,
it helps. Really, you know, and word of mouth, you know, that kind of helps the most. I still think today. So tell us if you can. You know, if you like what we're doing, you know, tell somebody about us. A movie fan, a movie friend, a movie buddy.
All right, guys, check us out. We will see you next time. Reality sucks. Keep watching movies with us, and check you out soon.
See you.